Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Good morning.
I understand you're back from a long trip overseas and been in India and Dubai, and you're back at work now handling all the easy problems at McMaster. And
oh yeah,
and I'm sure you're dealing with the same incredibly warm weather and lack of ice for your hypothermic plunges. Been a struggle this year.
There hasn't been snow. I don't know. Maybe Southern Ontario has not seen snow. I don't believe we've had a winter. We've had cold temperatures. We just don't believe we've had a winter here, which is different than other parts of the world and certainly other parts of Canada. But
California with 10 feet of snow or some crazy stuff. But anyway, I've got my Ortho Joe mug. And of course, to our guests, you will be, if you haven't already, receiving these absolutely priceless. Gerard has his. I hope you're using it with pleasure and find it that the caffeine levels are adequate for your work today. But so, Mo, why don't you introduce our guests, long-time friends of yours and
mine. Yes, I'd like to welcome both back. I think both have been on our podcast before, I believe. Maybe Sheila, I don't know if this is your first time, but Dr. Sheila Sprague is an associate professor in the Department of Surgery at McMaster University, has been a longtime collaborator and has run a number of trials. This one, she is a co-principal with Gerard Slobogin, who himself also was an associate professor and director of research in the Department of Orthopedics at the University of Maryland, and Sheila coming from McMaster. Welcome both. To you today. And certainly, I wonder if I can just start off. For those of you who aren't aware, I mean, there are times when there are these benchmark trials that are published. And it's important, I think, for everyone in the orthopedic community to be aware of them. This is just one of those important examples. The trial came out in the New England Journal of Medicine not that long ago. The title was Skin Antisepsis Before Surgical Fixation of Extremity Fractures. And maybe what I'll do is I'll ask Gerard to kind of sum up what the trial, the primary trial question and the findings, and maybe we can move to a broader issue of, what happens now.
Thanks, Mo and Mark. Thanks for having us. And thanks for the kind words about this being a landmark trial. I think this trial really was designed to answer a simple question, which is what sort of antisepsis should you use prior to your skin incision when you're doing extremity fracture surgery? And as we know, ChlorPrep or chlorhexidine and alcohol has been the sort of industry standard for at least a decade, and it's what most surgeons use. But the other product that seems to be on most hospital shelves, which is iodine povacrylex in alcohol or DuraPrep in North America, has also been around for a long time. And it really asks a simple question: which one of these is better? Which one of these will lower surgical site infections? And if there's a small difference between the two, as surgeons, we should probably switch. And that's what the study looked to do. It enrolled about 8,500 patients, both open fracture patients and closed fracture patients, and followed them for surgical site infection and reoperations.
Gerard or Sheila, on this one, was there any issues of methodology that was unique to this, something that you think is going to become the norm as you think about these large studies?
Yeah, well, there were several unique things about the trial. The first one was that it was very pragmatic in nature, meaning that it followed, it was conducted in real world conditions. We had like really broad eligibility criteria. We were able to enroll most patients with opened or closed fractures. We adequately powered the trial so we could analyze the open fractures and the closed fractures separately, so they weren't conducted as a subgroup analyses, which I think was a really like important thing that we did, so we could see the difference in closed fractures and see that there was no difference in open fractures. We also had a high level of patient and partner and stakeholder engagement throughout the course of the trial, from the beginning to the closeout and that. The trial also followed a cluster crossover randomized design instead of the typical parallel arm randomized trial. And in this design, the clusters or hospitals or surgical practices are randomized once to the treatment solution in which they began. And then they crossed over every 2 months to the alternate treatment solution until the trial was completed. So I think that really sparked a lot of interest from our clinical sites in that and kept them really engaged and excited about the trial. Those are some of the few things that we've done.
So let me ask this. Could you go back to a standard, what we call standard, randomized one-to-one, having gone through the experience of a cluster design in terms of just, you know, people's compliance to it? Would you go back to that approach? And I guess it's always question dependent, but looking at having done both, which one would you endorse more than the other now?
I think it really depends on your research question. And I think that really drives the design of your trial. I'd be very happy to do another, have the opportunity to present to do another very pragmatic, high enrolling trial. Like, we had kind of the opposite problem in this trial, that patients were coming in very, very quickly for the data collection and enrollment. And we had to come up with systematic strategies to ensure that sites didn't get overwhelmed with participant enrollment and data collection and follow-up. Whereas in many of the traditional RCTs, the fractures are rare. And so you're enrolling slowly, like you're enrolling one or two patients a month at a site if you're lucky, versus multiple patients at a site in a month. So I'm happy to do either trial design. We typically have very good compliance with our protocols, and we've, like, you know, back from the sprint days with you and Mark, we've learned a lot about compliance and design, and have a really solid team of clinical sites who strive to do the best.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, if I could, Sheila, before we go on to the next steps for the findings of this trial, are there other things that you've learned in the Method Center after, I don't know, dozens of trials that you've done? What have been the learnings since that sprint trial?
I think we've come quite, like, I think sprint was the first trial I did kind of right out of undergrad, working with you and Mo. We've developed more. Our Methods Center infrastructure has grown a lot. We have a lot of better standard operating procedures and templates and just procedures. Like, we've really refined the recipe for doing trials. We have more training, more awareness of some of the trial designs. I also think engaging our patient partners and coming up with a lot of the, like, thinking ahead of these are some of the problems that are going to occur. Like, compliance with treatment is something, like, what are the risks? Like, we do a bit of a risk assessment to the protocol. So it's kind of like, where are we at most risk? We're at risk of missing patients. We're at risk of enrolling ineligible patients. We're at risk of patients not receiving the treatments. We're at risk of losing patients to follow-up or having poor data quality. What can we do to mitigate all of these risks? And some of it is having procedures and standards in place. Some of it's more training. A lot of it is just discussing and having multiple meetings and that to engage everyone, to get them on board, to work through things.
Yeah, I'm thinking, for any people who are at centers where they're trying to consider or are considering having the starting a Method Center, that they really should consult with you and the learnings that you've had at MAC, which I think have really advanced the fields. But let's switch now. Gerard, we were talking briefly in the interview that to have aspirin and beta blockers after an acute MI event, it took 18 years for that to become standard of care. How are we going to avoid this with the findings of your trial?
Well, we've got a couple ideas, and I guess time will see. You know, so at the beginning, I mentioned the trial design and the research question, but, you know, we didn't actually talk about the results. And the results showed that for closed fracture surgery, the iodine povacrylex, the DuraPrep, reduced the risk of infection by 0.8%. You know, these are low infection rates. And overall, that's a relative reduction of 26%. So a pretty large effect for closed fractures, and a similar effect size in open fractures, but a lot more uncertainty. And you know, we don't conclude any statistical significance there. But I think as you're asking, what do we do now? So now we have a very simple intervention that's in every hospital at your fingertips. And it's, you know, in most places, it's as simple as just picking the other solution that's on the shelf. And so the data alone should be compelling enough, but we realized that changing behavior is hard and changing processes. Even in my hospital, we actually have a policy that suggests chlorhexidine and alcohol. So I had to already go and try and change the policy. But I think the fundamental way that we're trying to address this is actually through a little bit of a behavioral economics perspective. And for any of you that have read the book Nudge, McFadden kind of goes through some of these things where you can increase friction, as they say, on one decision and decrease friction on another. And I think a great example would be, you know, a lot of our operating rooms aren't just ortho operating rooms, so they have to be available for everybody. So I can't just dictate the solution that's going to be in that operating room. But for example, I could put the DuraPrep in the front of the cabinet in an open container, and I can put the ChloraPrep right behind it in a closed container. And that's just going to add a little bit of friction, make it just a little bit harder to use the ChloraPrep, but the surgeon, of course, can still do so if they want. Or you can put it in the sterile core where they have to, you know, walk 10 feet to go get it. And I think we are looking at some of these ideas. We're working with a behavioral insights group at the University of British Columbia to develop this. We're working with patient partners. We have great OR nursing experts that are helping us and lots of surgeon buy-in. And Sheila talked about the stakeholder engagement. We're continuing that into the implementation phase.
Jordan, I mean, it seems that could be a trial itself, right? I mean, just based on, I mean, almost like a trial of behavior, you know, simple placement of, you know, one solution over the other, one open, one closed, and just randomized of, you know, having that approach versus another. And you would be able to, I think, if you track it, get a pretty good sense of, you know, probably quantitatively, you know, just what kind of changes you're seeing in terms of usage, because that would be tracked in the OR notes for sure, would it not?
Yeah, I think Sprint and some of the trials that you guys did early really just opened our eyes to what's possible in clinical trials. And turns out there's a whole specialty and a whole bunch of people that actually know how to design novel trials. And so, as Sheila mentioned, we use this really cool multiple period cluster crossover design. Well, there are other designs out there. And so the next design we're going to use is a stepped wedge design, where we slowly bring in these interventions that I just mentioned, these behavioral interventions and sort of checklists for changing the behavior into each hospital one at a time. Sort of, you could almost imagine 1 month at a time. And by the end, that means everybody has had the intervention. And that's what makes it a stepped wedge. And it's another great design that we can do a sort of a pre-post in a rigorous way. And at the end, everybody ends with the intervention. So hopefully everybody's now increased their implementation of these findings.
Can I ask both of you, is there a possibility of using artificial intelligence and kind of modeling different trial designs to help you come up with the best design? Has anybody been working on that?
I don't think you need to use artificial intelligence per se. There's lots of modeling. In fact, you know, this study design and a lot of newer study designs don't use the simple online sample size calculator anymore. They do simulate the trial.
Okay.
And so we did 10,000 simulations to figure out, you know, what our power would be of the trial. And a lot of the other stuff that we're doing with hierarchical outcomes and things like that sampling simulation model is used every single time for our power calculations now.
So most certainly, you know, in the grant, you know, I know that you received, you know, sufficient funding, and even though it seems like a lot, it never ends up being enough. But that being said, you would have written your knowledge translation plan. I know there's all agencies now really require a thoughtful knowledge translation plan. I would imagine that one of them would have been that you have such a large network of investigators that you're going to be mobilizing each and every one of them to go into their respective ORs, their respective rounds, all these sorts of things. I mean, has that been happening, I guess? And how are you tracking that? Because I know we all write that, truthfully, but I am curious about the implementation of a KT, because at the end of the day, the truth is, you know, it's amazing to have a high impact paper, but it's everything after that really matters. You can think about it in terms of surgical care too. It's all the stuff that happens before you actually do the surgery and everything that happens after that can really have a huge impact overall, you know, on the outcome. So I'm curious about what's been happening beyond some of these other innovative things you're doing, sort of the bread and butter stuff that we would normally do.
Sure. Sheila, do you want to comment on any of the KT stuff and some of the challenges there? It's a lot of unfunded work. you know?
Yeah. We've made our presentations. Jordan and I presented at the Orthopedic Trauma Association in October. I presented Prepare at the specialty day at AOS a couple weeks ago. We've also got a fair bit of like some media attention. I was at a meeting last week and UpToDate. I talked to a senior editor at UpToDate and they were aware of the paper and we're going to make a few changes to their site. We've been promoting through Ortho Evidence and different avenues. We have the presentations and results available and we've shared them with our network of over 200 collaborators who co-investigators who participated in the Prepare trial. We're presenting it at rounds and we'll continue to do so. I think it is an area where researchers need to do more and funding at the end could be provided. A little more funding could be provided to enable us to do so. But yeah.
Oh yeah, it's a huge area, right? I mean, yeah. And the truth of the matter is it's like anything else. It's going to be big news for that, you know, cycle that is, you know, mm-hmm. the cycle when people are talking about it, or a big meeting cycle when you've had the launch, the paper comes out, and like anything else, the news cycle changes to the next hot topic. And how do you keep, you know, sort of the megaphone about your important findings in a way, especially on top of just what's happening in orthopedics, you know, outside of orthopedics, you know, in other specialties, they actually believe the opposite. Like they genuinely mm-hmm. believe that, you know, the evidence favors something else. And so you've got that group of people also talking and saying, well, why are your results different than what we know? And, you know, and I guess what I'm not necessarily giving answers. I'm just more curious, right, about how do you handle all this? Because that's the reality of change, right? You have such an important study. How do you make sure it sticks?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack there, Mo. You know, I think first off, when we wrote the grant, it's really hard to write a KT plan, a knowledge translation plan, when you don't know the results. Yeah. And so, you know, we're very proud of our PREPID investigators group, as we call it, 34 sites. And we published the first trial, the aqueous PREP trial, you know, the previous year in The Lancet, but there was no difference detected between aqueous solutions of chlorhexidine and iodine. So the impact, although helpful, you know, wasn't practice changing. And so now we have these results, which I think should be practice changing because, again, most people are using chlorhexidine and alcohol. So now we have to adopt a different strategy. And you know, I really want to sort of recognize Ashley Levack at Loyola and Nathan O'Hara at University of Maryland because they are going to lead that next phase. We need some funding to be able to do that. And they're going to put in that checklist and run that step wedge design that I was talking about. But I think you also bring up this other point about, are these results transportable to other orthopedic groups? You know, should the arthroplasty surgeons be doing this? Should the spine surgeons be doing it, foot and ankle, et cetera? The short answer, of course, is that the trial didn't include those patients. So I can't give you must recommendations. However, I personally, as an orthopedic surgeon, but not one that practices in these fields, I do think it's likely that it transports. And I think the similarities of extremity surgery, of metal implants going in, right, and different flora with longer study follow-up than the previous literature really supports why this study probably transports to the other disciplines. And then lastly, I think it's really important to recognize that there were no previous trials comparing iodine povacrylex in alcohol to chlorhexidine in alcohol, right? So this chloroprep-duroprep comparison hasn't actually been done. Most of the previous comparisons were chlorhexidine in alcohol versus povidone iodine or betadine in water. And that's what changed our practice in 2010, 2011. But that's not what this trial did. This trial really looked at what's on the shelf in modern day. And this was the first large comparison of it. And so I think you should really consider these results and consider whether you should change your practice if you're not a fracture surgeon.
Well, that's a really great way to end this. But I will say, Gerard, that I know the current editor of the GBGS and the future editor, and I think both would be interested in kind of a what's important essay, if you will, on dissemination and what your and Sheila's thoughts are, your group's thoughts on how you can implement change and get it to be practice standard of care without that 18 years business going on. So we'll talk to those editors and we'll hopefully see a submission. But Mo, do you have any last questions for our guests?
No, not at all. I mean, I just can't thank you both, you know, for, you know, doing this. It's easy. It's really easy to come on after the fact, right? Mm-hmm. And talk about, you know, sort of the glory of it, representing, I realize you two are representatives of a much larger collaborative, but the, you know, hundreds of members of the PREPARE group, the PREPIT trial investigators, the patient engagement team, the research coordinators, I mean, they are the engine that has made this trial possible and continue to be the engine that makes so many other trials possible. So, I mean, this is just really a huge thank you. You know, it's great to be in our field of orthopedic surgery when you see, you know, such strong, collaborative, global partnerships come together and yield fruitful information.
Yeah, absolutely, Mo. And there's 300 plus people to mention, so we won't be able to mention them all. But as Sheila said, that we really had a unique partnership with three patients that were with us throughout the entire journey. And so I do think it's mentioning at least three people, recognizing I'll forget a lot of others, but Jana Palmer, Deb Marvel, and Jeff Wells really shared their experience and guided every aspect of this trial. And this trial wouldn't have been possible without those patients.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's really a testament not only to really smart and experienced people designing a trial, Sheila and Gerard, but it's also perseverance, which that's been my experience, that that's probably the most important characteristic. And kudos to you and every member of the team that made these results possible for us to improve care of our patients. So enjoy your absolutely priceless Ortho Joe mug as you carry through the day, and we'll talk to you soon. And we'll be speaking with the editors about that upcoming submission.
Excellent.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye.